horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back. Hour two, just a couple of minutes before, and I couldn't let Ladies Island go through the ring this afternoon without a chance to congratulate Rich and the Matisse team on all of her success. It's got to be one of those bittersweet situations. Rich Averill joins us, Averill Racing. Rich, congratulations, first of all, on everything she accomplished.
Thank you.
Rich, it's got to be a mixed feeling situation, or are you just, you know, you play the claiming game, so horses sometimes come and go, but, you know, she's been so good for you guys.
Yeah, no, it's, it's sad to see her go, but, financially, I think it's the best move for her. She needs to start making babies, so. From what everybody is telling me that, now she's seven, she'll won't have her first baby till she's eight, and, they wouldn't have any runners till she's 10. So, she's, getting on to the end of her career as far as breeding. So I think it's time to do that. And hopefully she brings a good number for us today.
Well, and on this topic, explain, the decision-making process and how, you and Paul and everybody and Georgina, how you make the decision to sell as opposed to, having had all this success, getting her covered and getting a baby or two out of her.
I mean, we've talked about it, I guess it's not a complete done deal. I mean, she's not sold yet, but, we've talked with Paul and Duke and everything. So, it is a decision. It's something that, you have to decide whether or not you want to, put up more money and, take more risk, or just take, off the table, what she's, accomplished for us, financially. It's, as you well know, it's very hard to make a profit in this game. And, we made a really good one with her. So, I know Paul and Duke both breed horses and I do as well. But obviously we're not going to give her away. She's gonna have to bring a certain number, but, I think it's the right thing to do. And we kind of talked about it and set it up for her to sell in this sale in February, opposed to in November in the big sale, for a couple of reasons. One, her pedigree is very light. So she would, she doesn't have to really go up against all the big guns that would have sold, like on the Night of Stars and all those big, the big mares that sold. That was number one. And then number two was to get a couple more races out of her. And that's, that worked out very well. So, we got a couple more wins and some more cash, and, so it all worked out.
Well, and of course, won a second Sugar Swirl, and then particularly perfect. And I don't know if you were just hoping that the rains would come and the race might come off. But how satisfying was it? I mean, assuming she changes hands today, how satisfying was it to send her off with a win?
Oh, it was great. It was great. She deserved that. She's been the queen down there at Gulfstream for a while. And so it was great to see, her go out on top, and, for them to talk about her that way. And, she got on a van the next morning, and she left Sunday, and then she got right to the sale yesterday morning. And I mean, she looks great. She's amazing. They can't believe how good she looks. Somebody was looking at her yesterday, and he said, the guy was like, if I buy her, does the groom come with her? Because she looks amazing. But she has they have no idea that, they think that, they sales prepped her or whatever. It's like, man, she just came from the track. So that just tells you how good of a job Georgina and them did. you know, getting her ready and the way she looks and everything.
You know, and we should fold in fold Georgina and Jerry Bennett and Danny Gargan into this, because you know, there were a lot of people that kept her in top shape. You know, ever since you know you guys claimed her, and you know, I don't, did she miss a? I guess in the TCA was the only misfire really in 3 years.
Yeah, that was the only one. She didn't seem to really like that track too much. But yeah, I mean, you know, mostly Georgina. You know, she did everything. You know, the other people, you know, helped out, but you know, they pretty much had a made horse. You know,
right?
They helped us out, but you know, so she gets most of the credit for that. But yeah, it's a good team. You know, to have good friends and good people like that that help you out and to do things. You know, you need those in this industry.
Well, 14, I'm just counting up. Do I have it right? She won 14 times for you guys.
I don't have the PPs in front of me right now. But, yeah, I think I know she won 18 times total out of 35 races. So she won over half of her races.
Yep. I said that. It's funny. I said the exact same thing earlier when I said you were going to be on, and that it – you know, retiring, having won more than she lost. And years ago in racing history, that was an important measurement. It seems to have lost its cachet. But being able to say that they won more than they lost, that counts for something.
So, and especially that many, you know, that many races, you know, I mean, to say, oh, I won half my races, and you know, you ran four times or six times or eight, you know, whatever. But to run that many races, you know, early on, and then if you look at, you know, what she did prior to us, you know, purchasing her, you know, it was, you know, there was a lot of seconds and third. I mean, shoot, it took her a few times to break her maiden, I believe.
Yeah,
you know, and then, you know, she was, you know, running back and forth, you know, with other things. So, it's awesome. I mean, she looks great. There's not a doubt in my mind. She's going to be an awesome mommy and broodmare. She's got so much class. She's got everything. She has everything you're looking for, except for, you know, the great, you know, pedigree. But, you know, sometimes, Michael Jordan was his dad, you know, super duper athlete. I don't know. LeBron James' parents, all great athletes. You know, doesn't mean that, you know, just because. You know, breeding isn't everything. It definitely helps, but she's a physical specimen, and I think whoever gets her is going to be a very, very, very happy camper.
Well,
for what she's been through, you know, to be, you know, to run, you know, I mean, to go to Oaklawn, scratch, van back, you know, run, then van back again. I mean, she's, you know, she's supposed to, like, the horse is supposed to lose weight, like, lose her condition, like, lose their call. I mean, and she is, like, blooming.
Tremendous. There's a lot to be said for the durability factor. She's out of a broad brush mare. And so, you know, some of the, you know, the stoutness, you know, by greatness, and there's, you know, certainly the race record and, the consistency and the fact that, you know, she really never had any significant time away from the racetrack.
No, we did good spotting her races, you know, trying to find, you know, good places for her to go. And then, you know, get her, when we did try the Saratogas or whatever, we made sure she was coming in good form. And it was a good team effort, and she's one of a kind, you know. It's going to be sad, you know. Been Payne Price is gone, and now she's going to be gone. And I got to, Paul and Duke and me, we got to get to work. We got to find some more, you know, once in a lifetime horses.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you bring up Payne Price, and you know, I think you know, the last time you visited, you know, we were talking about both, and I had Georgina on as well, and you know, to claim a horse for 16 and to have them run for 3 years and you know, do this kind of work and amass this kind of a record, it's you know, how many horses do you figure, you know, you've claimed, Rich, in your time around the game?
Probably 100. Probably 100. So, she's, you know, those are, I would say, without a doubt, my best two.
Yeah.
I might have had some that won more races, maybe, but for what, you know, like, money-wise, would pay any price. You know, he was good. And then, you know, Ladies Island as well. I mean, she's put a lot of money in our pockets, and hopefully more today. But yeah, those are definitely the two best claims that I've had.
And I can't remember. I think we talked about the claim of pay any price, but I don't remember talking about Ladies Island and what attracted you to her when you took her.
So I was at Tampa Bay Downs the day she was a maiden, and she just, like, she ran, like, right to the lead, like, fast as could be, and then when she came back, where my box is, it's, like, right there, and I'm like, man, she's huge, you know, she's enormous, and I just couldn't, you know, and the trainer that had her, you know, he's not a well-known trainer, so... I mean, for a horse to show that much speed, you know, that early, and just, you know, I was like, she was on my radar, and then I didn't claim her the next time, and then she might have won or something, and then she went up to Delaware, and, you know, I'd forgot about her. I don't really follow Delaware, and so she came back to Tampa, and I believe she did run for a claim. And she won easy, and I was there again. I was like, "Jeez, I cannot believe I missed this filly again." And so then they run her in, like, I think they might have ran her in, like, a stake or something.
They
I don't
did.
Know. It's, you know, Tampa can be tricky. It was hard. It's hard to get this right races. And I think she tried two other there, and, you know, couldn't do it. And I don't know. They tried her on the grass or whatever, and, you know, and then. So it's like they were kind of like stuck and not, you know, with conditions wise. She wasn't like as good enough for the stakes, but she was, you know, she was probably too good for the lower level. So I don't know. I think they might have ran her in a couple stakes or something, and she ran no good. And then she was in for 16. It was a starter allowance, I believe. You had to have started for 10,000 or less, or you could have been, or you could be in the race but run for a 16 claim. And I called Duke up and I said, "Look, there's this filly I had my eye on, and, you know, I'm claiming her and I'm taking the money and that's it." So I claimed her, and she ran third, I believe, that day. And, you know, as she was going and getting ready and this and that, you know, they said, they're like, Duke was with me. I think we were on the phone or something, and they said, "I'm telling you this." He's like, you know, this dude was like, "Oh, you know, give me a little update on my horses and blah, blah, blah." And so they told him, you know, "Here, this one. And he goes, "At Ladies Island, that one's going to be a better claim than pay any price." And, you know, me and Duke are like, "Get the fuck out of here. You're smoking crap. There's no, you know, like, stop it." I mean, that's insane. So, and I mean, I guess they were right.
and you know, she, you know, you offered her back actually for 25, and you know, then she, that's about the time, January of 19, she, you know, she was running, actually, you know, she basically was still running the same kinds of races, and then it seems like as she got to be mature as a 5-year-old, and this is a story, Rich, that gets repeated so often, you know, we just don't get enough horses, male or female, mares and horses that get to full maturity, because you don't, yeah. you know, you don't know what you've got. And by the time they get to five, in some cases, they've been dinged up, or there's, you know, they've been run over their heads, and they've lost confidence. And so you get horses to this point, and you really, you know, if you haven't worn the tread down on the tire, these are the kinds of horses you can result in.
Yeah, and that was the thing, you know, that was the whole, like, I don't have the PPs in front of me, but that was the thing with her. Like, you know, we obviously did not want to lose her for the 30, and I mean, we were the only ones in for 16, so why they would claim her for 30, you know, we felt pretty confident that that was not going to happen. So, and that's what we wanted, you know, we wanted an easy race, like you said, confidence. Horses' confidence, winning is everything. You know, it's everything. They know when they win. You know, they're very smart animals, so they know. And and that was the thing. So, you know, we did the confidence thing with her, and then I believe we did another like confidence thing with her at Tampa. You know, like an easy race there, and then she hadn't shown those bigger numbers yet, but so then like I believe after that then we ran her in a Gulfstream in a two other van or something, and she that's when she really we were like, wow, you know, that was a big race, because I believe Jason Service had a horse in there that couldn't lose for I believe Dub, and you know, we went right to the lead, and she just never looked back. And then we got lucky with a couple off the turf 5/8, you know, dirt races, and I believe one race that paid any prices in, and he had to scratch, and so she won. So, and she got lucky too. And then, like you said, now the confidence that all those races in a row that worked out for her, you know, built her into, you know, pumping her chest, I guess, because, you know, she just really kicked it into another gear as she got older.
Yeah, and you mentioned there's a couple of things that come with this, and the way in which, you know, you get to this point by running, at the lower level, you're eligible for all kinds of starters. And let's also really acknowledge, she loves a wet track.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. There's no doubt about it. She's a, I think, what is she, 7 for 10?
7 for 10.
Yeah.
Did she win? I'm just looking. She never, did she win at, did she get a chance to win at Calder? She did. She did.
On the turf.
On the turf, she won at Calder. Yes. Yeah. So Tampa, Delaware, Gulfstream West/Calder.
Saratoga.
Yeah. Nice. Wow.
Can be tricky. I mean, you talk about some of the trickiest tracks in the country. I mean, Saratoga, Calder, Tampa, you know, they're all different, you know.
They are. And she, as we said, I mean, only one, let's see, in 35 starts, missed the board, 27, missed the board only 8 times, and four, five fourths. So, I mean, she picked up checks in all but, I think, 3 of her starts. Yeah, there's a 6.
Yeah, and I think 2 of them were on the grass with somebody else in stakes races. So,
unbelievable. Well, this record, 665,557, and I won't ask you about a reserve, but is she selling with a reserve, obviously?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, we're not going to give her away. You know, I got to talk to Paul and Duke today, and come up with the exact number. I'm here. I'm at the sale. So, we'll come up with a game plan and go from there. But she's getting, you know, quite a bit of action, and they love her. I mean, like I said, they did a great job with her, getting her to this point. they are, everyone is just, they couldn't believe, you know, the consigner, like, you know, the people of the sales company, they couldn't, you know, they just couldn't believe how great she looked. So she came in great shape, and there's not a doubt in my mind that she's going to be good at what she does. So hopefully we get lucky and, you know, the right two people, like her, and, you know, they want her.
Well, Rich, excited for you guys to close out this chapter, and excited for whoever gets her, and we'll watch for her second career as a brood mare, and you know, start digging in those PPs, and you and Dookie and Paul find a couple of new ones.
We're gonna try. I mean, it's a tough act to follow, but we're gonna do our best. You know, we play the game in every aspect, all of us. You know, we buy, we sell, you know, try to buy privately, we claim, you know, we try to, you know, they breed, I breed. We never bred together, but, you know, we all do it, you know, individually. And we kind of gamble a little bit.
You've been known to gamble. And in fact, normally we'd probably be in Vegas this week or last week, but we're going to have to wait. That's going to be the strangest situation for us to all pick up and head to Vegas in August.
Yeah, it's going to be in the middle of Saratoga too, right?
I know, yeah, to take off for a week. Yeah, we're going to get it. I think everybody's going to try to get a little Del Mar in at the same time, you know, maybe ahead. I think that's what I'm going to try to do, take Tina to Del Mar for a few days.
That'd be good
as well. Rich, we'll be
watching
the sale.
Are you coming to Tampa for the big races?
It's funny you say that. I said to Tina this morning, I said, well, I don't think I'm going to go down and broadcast for a few days ahead of Tampa Bay Derby. Not after I saw that scene. the super spreader event on Sunday night, all over the, I mean, that was, I don't know. I think I'm going to have to watch the testing results for a few weeks. did you go to the game?
No, I did not. I did not go to the game.
Yeah. Well, it was, I'll tell you what.
I watched it at home.
Yeah, it was.
The tickets were crazy. I mean, it was like $9,000 for nosebleeds. I wouldn't pay $9,000 to watch anybody play anything.
No, you've got a way to put that to better use.
Yeah, sure. I'm sick, but I ain't that sick.
There you go. Rich, this was great. Good luck later this afternoon. Rooting for you guys.
All right, thank you.
I really appreciate Rich Averill, everybody, and Averill Racing and Team Matisse with Ladies Island, HIP 542, if you want to watch the sale and see where her new home may be. And we'll start to see about who's going to cover her and watch for babies. We're going to stay right here. And Diana Pakulski is joining us first, and we're going to be joined by Chris Hyde as well. And, you know, any reason's a good reason to talk to Diana, and her long commitment to particularly to aftercare and her long association with the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and working in different capacities. The story yesterday that appeared in TDN that Diana wrote, coming from the legislation that made it through the state Senate and is expected to pass the assembly. And it's a basically it's a bulwark against a slaughter, you know, the slaughter avenue, the slaughter pipeline. And we'll talk about it with Diana. And then Chris is going to join us from a national perspective. First and foremost, Diana, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. And it's terrific to talk to you. And this will be an update for a lot of stakeholders and fans and people that, you know, very often have to confront, disturbing pieces of news. It's It's an arena, though, that there's so many cross purposes when it comes to this discussion. Talk about this particular ban, essentially, and whether it's slightly symbolic or if it has teeth.
Oh, I think it definitely has teeth, and it's interesting in a few different ways. You know, New York as a state has been for years, I mean, going back to when John Hettinger was alive and very active in this field, been, you know, working to pass a ban on slaughter in New York. What's really interesting about this piece of legislation is that it also gives the Gaming Commission information about the horse registration, you know, about the microchipping. The bill says that all the horses will be microchipped, which the Jockey Club was going to do anyway. And so it gives the state some way to enforce this and also keep track of the horses. When I was on the governor's task force about retired racehorses years ago, we did a study, and one of the most disturbing things that came out of that was all of the horses that just got lost. You know, we did a study of all of the horses that were bred in 1 year in New York and where they ended up. And there were so many that you couldn't track down. And so they've been talking about different ways to deal with that. And this, I think, is sort of a compromise, you know, versus licensing, so to speak, every horse that's, you know, bred for racing, which is a, you know, controlled activity in the state. So I think, is a really interesting aspect of it. And the fact that there is some funding built into it to help care for the horses. You know, I mean, right now that the bill is not going to cost the state anything, which is an important aspect of getting it passed, especially in a budget year like this. And if there are violations and there are fines, then that money will go towards helping to care for retired racehorses that are living in and, you know, being rehabilitated within the state. So those are two really interesting parts of it.
Diana, how because this, you know, bubbles to the surface, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, out of not out of left field, but, you know, you think about, I think we had the incident, well, now it's probably over a year ago, particularly acute in Louisiana. And, you know, there, you know, there's the, you know, the various, you know, auction alarms that go off. Explain where things stand now. And you could use New York as, you know, as the, you know, the main discussion point, but and we're reaching for Chris Hyde now for the national perspective and to fold in the SAFE Act's status. But explain where we are right now in terms of, you know, keeping horses out of harm's way when it comes to, you know, the slaughter pipeline.
Well, there's never been a federal ban on horse slaughter yet to pass in the United States. So the truth is that in a lot of states, if somebody wanted to set up a slaughterhouse, they could, except for the fact that there have been a number of people who have religiously gone in every year and had the inspection of slaughterhouses with horses defunded. So technically they can't open up, but they can transport their horses over the border. And so that's what's happening now. And, you know, that has to stop. And so the SAFE Act is one way to deal with that situation. I mean, there's different ways to address it. You could have a federal ban on the transportation of horses for slaughter. That, you know, there's different opinions about which is the most enforceable of those types of bills. But the one that right now seems to address the problem in the most logical way to the most people is the SAFE Act, which Chris can explain, deals with the fact that you have all of these animals that are not raised or kept in a way consistent to have them be safe for people to consume, being transported over the borders for consumption by humans.
Well, and with that introduction, Chris Hyde is with us as well. And Chris, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. And it's been a while since we've discussed this. And you know, there's been any number of attempts to get the SAFE Act, attached and passed. We'll talk about who the opponents are and who has made this difficult. But explain to everybody where the SAFE Act legislation stands, what it involves, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Well, we obviously, you mentioned the SAFE Act, which is the Safeguard American Food Exports Act, and it's probably the third or fourth incarnation of a bill that we have been introducing since 2002 to ban the slaughter of horses for human consumption. And as the name implies, this one kind of deals with the food safety component, the aspect that all of the drugs that, legal, illegal, very common things that are given to horses every day are highly toxic to humans. So that's kind of the approach with the SAFE Act this time, is to show that it's a toxic meat. You know, that if you want to make horses a consumer animal, for consumption, you're going to have to regulate the drugs and all of that stuff on every level that goes into it. So that's kind of the basic foundation of what this bill will do. We are getting ready to reintroduce it. There's a new Congress, obviously, new administration, all that came in the beginning of January. So at that time, with the new Congress starting, we have to step back and get all of the bills reintroduced, and that is including the SAFE Act, which we're working on right now, getting reintroduced. It could come at any time once the Senate kind of picks up business.
Well, they've got some business to handle right now today, starting. So let's get that successfully implemented. explain who has worked against the SAFE Act these last 19 years, because it's a cabal that is as ugly as it can be imagined.
Yeah, it's been a very kind of amazing transformation, at the beginning. And some of these groups probably aren't going to like mentioning the names. You know, really the very first group out of the gate to oppose this, didn't even put their name on the paper, where they were just kind of sending an email around. Well, it wasn't even an email. They were sending a hand-dropped letter around. It was the American Horse Council. And then with time, there were some good people within the Horse Council that kind of got them to go neutral. And then the Veterinary Medical Association kind of took the mantle of attacking the bill, and they still oppose it. They realized it was not necessarily something they wanted to be seen as the face of, so they backed back and let the equine vets take the lead on it. And then they got bashed. And, so we've kind of had this transformation through kind of the livestock industry, the Quarter Horse Association, and now it's really, there actually is nobody lobbying against it on Capitol Hill. They don't have lobbyists anymore. But there's been just enough, doubt seeded. You get the cattlemen, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, all they have to do is come to the Hill. They're there all the time getting, large handouts. And they'll just kind of say in passing, we can't have this bill passed. It's not a big priority for us, but it's just, slippery slope. So that's kind of where we are now. It's lack of muscle from the advocacy side and a lack of will from anybody in Congress. We're just kind of caught in a stagnant position on Capitol Hill, and everybody lets it swirl. The groups are still making money fighting it, and it's just circling, you know, unsuccessfully. So that's unfortunately where we're stuck at the moment.
There's also quasi or straw man, you know, animal welfare entities that that have weighed in on this, right? Is it the Welfare Council that's against it as well?
Yeah, well, that's you have the animal welfare groups, your traditional animal welfare groups, you know, that you see their ads on television. You know, with Sarah McLachlan and the heart dragging, all of that kind of stuff. And then you do have, and it was actually in conjunction with the Rodeo Association and an equine vet created this Animal Welfare Council,
mm-hmm.
which they have a website. They pop up. They attack anything. They, ironically, it's just industry backed, you know, from a couple of people, and they kind of attack everything. You know, but ultimately, all of their excuses have panned out to be, you know, nonsensical, and you know they haven't had a lot of influence on the Hill, and you know, so it's, you know, it's kind of, again, they kind of sowed the seeds with this, and you know, now we don't have great champions really going to the mat for it like we've had in the past, and you know, just a little whisper campaign is enough to keep it down, unfortunately, in the House, so in the Congress, so that's, you know, it's a real just sad mess. After all these years, because there's tremendous support for it.
Well,
we just can't get it over the finish line.
At the very least, though, I guess the positive that has maintained the status quo, there had been the initiatives from, you mentioned the horsemen, and the cattlemen's groups, particularly, you know, in you know, Big Sky Country and so forth,
mm-hmm.
that were trying to reopen slaughterhouses. That at least has been kept at bay.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, you know, the closest they came some years ago when there was a year lapse, you know, we block the Department of Agriculture from spending money to inspect plants.
Right.
And if you can't inspect those plants, they can't. So we have to do that every year. One year that lapsed, and they rushed to try, not really seriously, more PR things, but they came very close in New Mexico. It was a former beef slaughterhouse that had been, it was the first and only slaughterhouse in the United States to be ever closed by the USDA for violations. They tried to then be opened as a horse slaughter facility, and the guy was crying, oh, everybody's picking on me. I'm just an honest businessman. It's like, no, you made history by being so bad that even the Department of Agriculture couldn't hide that. You know, so we did have this, the governor came out against it. She was a Republican. The attorney general came out against it. He was a Democrat, the land commissioner. So we had great support in that state. To come out against it. So, you know, they do try, and, you know, they've tried going to Indian reservations, but that ultimately still wouldn't get around it. You know, they try all these little tactics to pop up, and so it's a constant fight, you know, on the state level and the federal level.
To that end, and explain where we are in terms of horses going over the border to Canada and Mexico. What's the status on that front?
That continues. You know, as I mentioned a second ago, that annual defunding language we put in only keeps them from opening here. That doesn't stop them from being sent across the border. You know, and so that's why we're so desperate to get the SAFE Act, to get the permanent ban on horse slaughter, because that would close the borders and close it here. So that's it's unfortunately kind of dragging that thing out. So we've seen the numbers have been decreasing every year by going, you know, having being shipped to Canada and Mexico. Some of it was because the EU realized how toxic American horse meat is. You know, they cracked down on getting it into the United States or getting it from the United States. Canada, you know, claims they quarantined the horses for a period of time. I mean, things like phenylbutazone, you can't quarantine that out of the body. There is no time period for that to come out of the system of an animal. So if they've ever gotten it, that should be banned. And I can't imagine many of, you know, horse owners have not given their horse bute. You know, it's a very common medication. So you, certainly with COVID, we've seen the numbers continue to drop. I think we're looking at about the high 30,000 horses now, which would be an all-time low since I've been doing this. And I hopefully, when it continues to shrink like that, you know, the market won't see a surge if things open within the United States. And then, you know, we're at a manageable number that we can say, okay, now, you know, horses aren't running down the streets. You know, we only have 30,000 horses, and, you know, that's not even actually what's in the pipeline. We can end this, and let's pass this bill. So we're going to keep using that messaging.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, what's our wish list, right? We need, you know, I mean, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act passed, and unfortunately, horse slaughter wasn't part of that. But now it seems like we need to get energy and money behind passing the SAFE Act. So kind of like, what's our wish list, Chris, for getting this done?
Well, I think you're right, Dana. You know, I mean, I've known you for 20 years on this issue, and I'll be upfront. I mean, our biggest success is when we actually had some major racing industry leaders. The late John Hettinger up in New York was just a rock star in this, 100% committed, you know, great connections in doing this. You know, and so that's somewhat of the hope, is finding those leaders again, you know, those that are politically smart and understand this, those who are really passionate about horses. And we haven't had it. I mean, I've been very open that the kind of the effort has been co-opted by animal groups that are making a lot of money keeping this out and saying, hey, send us a check and we're going to keep fighting. You know, so there's always that financial incentive to not put it over the edge. Especially on horse slaughter, which is there. But as you said, it should have been attached to that bill. That bill moved immediately fast. And I'll also be very honest, horse slaughter was pushed under the bus. You know, I know firsthand that, you know, you'll get legislators will say, well, you've got two bills. Which do you want to move? And it's just who screams the most for one, the other one can get kind of pushed to the side. And that's what's happened with horse slaughter. It got run over by a bus in this when it should have been easily passed. I mean, it doesn't impact anybody, really, you know, in a serious level. So I think that's the thing, is getting back to getting those serious big-name people who will step up, you know, and be able to donate to this effort to get real serious lobbying and outreach and education and awareness. So that's kind of the first thing, is to change the mission and take it back. Take the campaign back to trying to end it now. I don't want to make
this
another 10 year.
And the industry is so much further along since it was when we started this 20 some years ago, right? Like now there's the Thoroughbred Aftercare Association. There's, you know, so many tracks have banned. We are banning people
absolutely.
Who let their horses go to slaughter. I mean,
that's absolutely. It's all
right,
positive. I mean, when the change has been, people often ask me, well, you haven't ended slaughter. What have you done? I'm like, oh my, you would not imagine the change with an aftercare issues and awareness with breeding and the increase of quality rescues that are well-funded, that are ready. I mean, the change is astounding in that time frame. So while we've not ended slaughter, the attitude and the awareness towards equine welfare has improved tremendously. And I give great credit to the thoroughbred industry. They have, all out of all industries, have gone further. They can go much further. I'm not going to defend, you know, with all of this. They are not backing the horse slaughter bill like they should, or at all, really. They kind of send some letters, which is great. But, you know, we need all steam ahead on ending slaughter. But they have made great strides in all of these things and have much further to go. And if we could get slaughter off the table, all of our resources could go to, you know, real equine welfare issues as it should be. So you're right, Dana. Changes have been dramatic, and we're so close. There's no reason to maintain this bill anymore.
Chris Hyde is with us, and Chris is a lobbyist in Washington. Blue Marble Strategy is his entity, and Diana Pakulski, who has spent pretty much her adult life caring and working for horses, particularly off the track thoroughbreds, and long association with the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation. Chris, why has this bill seemingly an easy piece of legislation, you would think, to slap on an omnibus bill? And year after year, I remember it being discussed that way, and that we'd get to a year end or to a budget session or whatever in Congress, and word was that it was going to make it through that way. What has continually stopped it from that?
I think it's kind of those things that I mentioned earlier. You've got animal groups that come up with three or four different horse bills, and they realize which one's making the most money. Horse slaughter's making a lot of money to kind of keep that fight going. So when you are in those rooms at the end of the year, you get one option or one choice, and horse slaughter's the easy one to push out of the way because, well, we can keep raising money, next year on it. We can keep it going. With that kind of thing. And I think also, a more critical point as well, we haven't really had proactive legislative leadership on Capitol Hill. We've got great sponsors of the bill. They're all passionate. But when it comes down to it, animal issues and horse slaughter is very easy to push out of the way. And it shouldn't be. When we've moved it before, we had John Sweeney, who used to represent Saratoga Springs area, would go, and he was really just swinging to get this thing done. And they made deals and, committed their votes. And they got us a hearing, and they got us a vote. And we came very close, but he was no longer around. And we don't have those kind of champions that are, they get their awards from the humane community, and then they kind of go quiet for a period of time again. And we need champions on that. And I think it will go back to what Diana said. We need real industry leaders and real major business people to step up and help support this effort, and say enough's enough with that kind of thing. It can be done. It's just getting that will at the last minute to do it.
In terms of the regional supporters or facilitators, when it comes to the auction centers, New Holland and so forth. Is there a reasonable approach to basically shut things down from that vantage point? Can legislative initiatives like Diana had here with Joe Addabbo, is that an approach to either slow or down to a trickle? I mean, as it is, I do see. I'm looking at numbers. The export, even before 2020, the numbers had basically been cut 50% from a high.
Yeah. It's tough with auctions because of what we've run into. And those have changed dramatically. When I first used to start going to New Holland and taking camera crews up there, there was no hay on the ground or straw on the ground, no hay, for feed, no water. Now they've always got fresh water and hay and straw on the ground. They've got fans in there. What we have seen, so when there was a crackdown on thoroughbred tracks regarding horses going to slaughter, they got smarter. They just started meeting at farms off of New Holland, private farms. And, so nobody could come in. The USDA couldn't be called. Law enforcement couldn't be called. We couldn't see what was going on. You didn't know what was happening. So, sure, no thoroughbreds are going through New Holland. A few were. But they were just going 20 miles down the road to a farm and being collected within these things. So that's kind of the hard part, on dealing with auctions. And we have made the impact, has been traumatic with them. It's just, it's difficult to get those other avenues until you can kind of have that ban, stopping the export out of the United States. That's really the thing. That's the chokehold, is getting them out of the country. If you close that down, there wouldn't be, any need for the market. So it's tough for a straight-out creative level around, at least on the federal level. I mean, we've tried three or four different versions of the bill, different committees. Had success in them all, but it's just ultimately that political will at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I remember certain people being instrumental in stopping the legislation. If I'm not mistaken, Bob Goodlatte was a linchpin. Is he still? If I'm not right, wasn't he the?
He was. Yeah, he was one of the first. And ironic, what started it with him, he had a senior staff person who was the son of a Texas Livestock Association person. And that Texas Livestock Association used to get $50 for every horse that was slaughtered because they were doing brand inspections. I'm sorry, you couldn't see me using air quotes right there because nobody was knowing. They weren't doing anything. So his son got Goodlatte to oppose the bill, and that kind of what triggered the early on all-out attack on this thing, where it created the term the unwanted horse. It got the industry to see this as the slippery slope if you're going after beef next. That was really under Goodlatte. And he has since retired. You had a couple of Adrian Smith from Nebraska who would attack the bill. Mark Wayne Mullen from Oklahoma would criticize the bill, and they still do behind the scenes. But it's had less of an impact. Now it's just kind of making leadership realize, that, okay, the opposition has died off and everybody's disappeared for the most part. Let's get this, because they're tired of hearing about this. One member said in committee a couple of years ago, I am so sick of hearing about horse slaughter, and I wanted to yell out from the back of the room saying, well, then pass a bill and
pass
I won't be
bill.
Here next year. It's like, I don't want to keep telling it to you. He's now gone. There are ways, and we're always looking for ways, but it's tough on a federal level because their regulatory ability is so narrow with it, just as a food animal, which is really their only path of how we have an avenue to it.
And I mentioned earlier this morning when I explained that you and Diana were going to join us to discuss this with the New York legislation in Albany as the backdrop. And, I can recall literally, this is a topic that I started talking about in the mid-aughts, 2006 or 7, with Glennie Kane Oakford. She would be, she would cover it for the Daily Racing Form. And, it is a topic that would alleviate, such a negative and completely justifiable, I would say, in terms of critique of the industry that we would put that we would allow our horses to be in harm's way in this sense. I will say this, and you talk about throwing under the bus. I do not want to lay everything at the feet of the quarter horse industry, but the reality is the thoroughbred industry is seemingly always trotted out as villainous. And the vast majority of these horses are quarter horses. I mean, they are the predominant percentage of the horses that are going over the border. And I'm not indicting the quarter horse side, but that's just a fact. And yet it's the thoroughbred industry that bears the brunt of this in the media.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I've always said that from somebody like myself, even though I've been introduced to the racing industry, having known, the greats like John Hediger and D.G. Van Cleef and others over these, 20 years with this, and I always was trying to say to John, I said, sell it to me, the public. All I know of the horse industry in the United States, and I grew up, my family had a farm in Ohio, so, you've got that connection to it. But as an industry, it's the Kentucky Derby and a thorough horse. That's the extent, every year I'd watch it, it was, extent of a great deal of the public's knowledge of this. So people are attacking the thoroughbred industry. I'm like, they contribute, but not on the scale of other breeds. And they at least have talked over the years in this. But, while all of the money and the attention that's on the industry, we've only had spurts of the industry's real interest in this bill. When we've had the Hedingers and some people many years ago which fought it, but literally days after John died, the NTRA kind of, you know, gave that looking in the air going, what? We never said anything about slaughter. You can't say we said anything about it. It was literally days after John died. It was kind of amnesia hit with that. So that, you know, so there is that frustration, as this is one thing everybody could so easily grasp. It's easy to get rid of because, again, it's not, you know, it's not like, you know, the other issues that face these industries. You know, this is a very kind of dark backroom thing, which is impacting a few horses. You know, if embraced, it would be such a such an amazingly popular position with the general public, and easy to address. You know,
that,
so I'm hoping. You know,
on that front, what can the thoroughbred stakeholder, the industry regulator, the horse player, the casual fan, what can all of us do right now to, you know, to help move this thing, you know, over the goal line?
Yeah, I think it's changing. It's making it not something that you talk about only when asked. I mean, you're really getting up and doing, you know, like we had before, or, you know, where we were getting a lot of articles published and attention and major horse industry owners. You know, I don't know if my list is still out there. I mean, we had all, at the time, all the Derby owners, all, you know, many of the trainers, you know, a lot of the tracks. Dick Duchessois helped us in Illinois with it. And it's, you know, coming back and getting these leaders that are, you know, really proactive in doing it, because these are people with, you know, successful business people, connections, you know, names and support and influence that, you know, if put behind this thing in a serious push. And it's going to take some lobbying, take some outreach, some education, ads, things like that, you know, which will take some resources. But I think it could be very easily done, because it was before. We came so close with
it. It's like a campaign similar to what they did with the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, you know, with hay, oats, and water, and
building that again, that strength and that network we had, because it was so big there for a period of time, and I said when John passed, then it kind of all just fell apart, you know, based on his personality. But I think, you know, that's what we need to do, is get back and use the influence and the name and the resources of the racing industry, you know, because it's an all win for them. You know, talk about a positive thing as you're standing up to keep horses from being slaughtered. You know, if you're going to want to draw the young people and the, you know, the new people into this, this is such a free issue. I can't tell you how many times people have said that on Capitol Hill. This is a free issue for people. You know, you should embrace it. And, you know, that's, again, you know, connecting back with Diana, you know, see if we can rebuild that and get the industry, you know, behind this and supporting efforts to move it forward.
Watch this space.
There you go. I'm happy to revisit this at any time, and you know that's why Diana, that's why I jumped when I saw your piece, and I said, I thought to myself, we really have not discussed it, except the occasional note in passing. We have not discussed it, you know, this thoroughly in several years. I would guess,
yeah,
3 or 4 years.
When Joanne Yepsen and I started our firm, this was, you know, one of our, it's been just about a year and a half now, but this was one of our top issues for sure that we want to accomplish.
Yeah, and it's so doable. I mean, you're right. I appreciate you doing this. I mean, the really only one not kind of in the industry that's talked about it is Jay Hovde, who's written on this, you know.
Yes.
He kind of brings it back, you know, to the forefront on talking about this and his frustration with the industry, you know, as well, kind of, because it's so, again, it's a no-lose issue for the racing industry to embrace this. And they can take the credit for it. Whoever can help me end it, you know, I'm going to go into the 20th year probably to get this thing done. I would like to end it in that sense, and it's so doable. It's just kind of putting the focus and making it a priority. That's what it has to be. It has to be. That's what sums up your first point. Now that I grab it, this has to be seen as a priority, not just something that you like. You know, I've often had activists say, "Chris, why can't you pass this bill? 70% of the public likes it." And then I ask them who their congressperson is. And they tell me, and I'm like, oh, my God, he's horrible. He votes against it. You know, we love him. We love how he is on health care. We love how – I'm like, well, then, you know, I can't help you. You know, if you keep sending me these people, you know, don't expect me to do it. So, you know, that's kind of what we face in this thing. It's like you've got to pull it out of thin air, but, you know, why can't you do it? But it is. It's one of those things. If we just made it a priority, it would be gone. We could end it in a heartbeat because there's nobody blocking it.
Well, that says something, and I'm sure that that's new information to some people. I owe Deanne Stillman a visit too, who wrote Mustang, and she approaches this topic via the BLM, and that are villainous in their own right, and there's so many angles to this that as you say, there shouldn't be any resistance, and it sounds like they're actually. May not be. It's just a question of getting one or two more thumbs on the scale, as it were.
That's exactly. Yeah, you're spot on. It's just somebody needs to realize. Members of Congress need to realize it's a priority. And if we start getting some big people calling in and telling them how that's impacting them, I think we can do that. You know, that's how we did it before.
Well, we'll collectively off air. We'll visit and come up with a additional strategy. And in terms of strategy work, Chris, Blue Marble strategy for anybody listening. What do they need to know about your other advocacy work?
I was in the animal movement for about 20 years, tied to doing horse slaughter is pretty much my defining issue. But, I left the animal movement kind of summing up what I've been talking about this, is that I wanted a new approach. I wanted to treat it as a business where you come in, you get the right people around you, you do it, you move on to the next thing. That should be treated and should be done. I still do my animal issues. I couldn't stray too far away from that in that career. But just kind of wanted to take a new approach to it. And that's the path that I've been on. And I think horse slaughter is kind of the perfect model to brand this all on and show how you can get things done.
Well, and you operate both nationally and locally as well, mm-hmm. and in state capitals around the country. And also, Diana, for you and your partner, talk about Jepsen and Podkulski.
Well, thanks. Joanne and I have been friends for many years, and when I was with the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, we did things together, collaborated when she was the mayor of Saratoga Springs and I was with the TRF. We collaborated on local things. I also took her around the country to see the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation farm. This type of thing has always been one that has interested her. So we started our firm because we wanted to do public affairs, so government relations, lobbying, media relations. We both draw from many years of experience in those kinds of things, and we want to help businesses that want to operate in the, in a good way for the community, and also we want to help nonprofits that need a fresh look or need new energy or need better messaging or need, help getting through sort of the government quagmire to accomplish things. So that's what we're doing.
Well, we appreciate this from both Diana Podkulski and Chris Hyde, and we will circle back whenever there's another story to tell or to encourage people to participate. And Diana, nice work on Albany, and we'll see about Washington and a national. Effect as well. So thank you both.
Excellent. Thank you, Steve.
Thank
I appreciate
you very
it.
Much.
Not at all. Not at all. Chris Hyde and Diana Podkulski on slaughter. And, you know, Jay Hufde is owed a visit, so it is a pet topic and project of Jay's. So maybe we'll get Jay in this week, too, because I had a couple of things for him in recent weeks. Let's take a break. Last of the morning, come back, and Andy Serling is going to join us, and we'll dive in to the racing from the weekend and more. Don Stevens later as well, because tomorrow you got the premiere. Usually it's premiere night, but this year at Delta, it's premiere day for the Lawbreds. Everybody loves the Lawbreds. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel...
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Sirius XM Sports presents